Welcome to the Robert Wenzel Show. Please stand by for Robert Wenzel.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Robert Wenzel Show. I'm Robert Wenzel. My guest today is Hunter Lewis. He is co-founder of Cambridge Associates, which is a global investment firm, and author of a number of books, including Where Keynes Went Wrong. Hunter is out with two books this week: Crony Capitalism in America, 2008-2012, and Free Prices Now, Fixing the Economy by Abolishing the Fed. So that should be some pretty exciting stuff to talk about. In the past, has been a trustee of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Morgan Library, the Thomas Jefferson Fund, and the Grattan School. He was also a member of the World Bank Pension Finance Committee. So, Hunter, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Okay, it sounds like you've got some exciting books coming out, and there's a bunch of different stuff I want to talk to you about, but I tell you, the thing that fascinates me most is that you were a trustee at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And I bring that up because I was actually once approached by the Rockefeller family to work for them, so I know they have their bird dogs out there and their tentacles out there looking for different people, and can you just tell us a little bit what that was about?
I was on that board for about a year, and the reason I joined that board was that a foundation that I was a director of merged with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, so I automatically was swept in the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and thought I would stick around for a little bit just to be sure the merger went appropriately.
Okay, and can you just give us a little bit of sense? You know, there are conspiracy theories out there as to how the Rockefellers operate and how they try to influence certain industries or sectors or government. Were you at all privy to any of those types?
No, I can't say that I have been. And of course, you know, maybe that would have been appropriate back in John D. Rockefeller the first day or the second day or something like that. But there's so many other wealthy families and others who are players in the economy that it seems strange to attribute everything to one family.
Yeah, but what are your thoughts on the fact that Paul Volcker was very close with the Rockefeller family, you know, ended up being Fed chairman? And then Alan Greenspan actually, in his book, writes about celebrating his birthday with David Rockefeller and just a couple of people around. I mean,
anybody living in New York, you know, would be having lunch or dinner with David Rockefeller. But it is interesting to discuss Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan in the same breath because, you know, one was really a hero, a Democrat who did the right thing, and the other was a villain appointed by Reagan, yet who started off all this boom-bust cycle that we've had.
Yeah, but from the reading I've gotten, I mean, now I'm talking Jimmy Carter's diaries. He mentions how David Rockefeller brought Paul Volcker to his attention. Then we have Alan Greenspan going to a private birthday party where David Rockefeller is in attendance, and it seemed there were only maybe a half a dozen people there. So he seems to be close to these people. We don't know what's going on, but I'm not ruling out the possibility that the Rockefellers still have tremendous influence out there.
President Carter did not want to appoint Paul Volcker. He was kind of forced into it because he made such a disastrous choice in his Fed chairman, who made such a mess that Carter didn't have much choice. He had to name somebody who would play, who would be approved by Congress. So he backed into Paul Volcker.
Yeah. No, there's no question. G. William Miller was a disaster. He came out of the manufacturing industry, had no understanding about monetary theory at all, and sort of really let the gates go. But if you read Clinton's diaries, it's clear in there that Rockefeller was a very, very strong influence on Volcker being named. And, of course, Volcker comes out of that Rockefeller gambit. He has been associated with Chase Manhattan Bank and the rest of that stuff. So there's no cut between the central bank and Rockefeller up through Greenspan.
I don't think, you know, Wall Street was very happy about Paul Volcker's policies, nor was the financial establishment in New York. Whatever his background, he behaved in a brave and courageous way, and he did the right thing.
Yeah, I think it was important in slowing down the inflation. He reversed engines in 1982, and of course we had a strong rally in the stock market after that. And then he tightened up just as he left and Greenspan came in. But I don't see a cut between Rockefeller influence and Volcker and Greenspan. Volcker and Greenspan both seem to be very close to Rockefeller, and I can't make anything more out of it than that, but it really seemed to be that way.
Ronald Reagan appointed Greenspan. You don't think of Ronald Reagan as being a Rockefeller agent.
Yeah, again, that sort of shows you what really goes on at the higher levels of politics. It doesn't seem to be as much Republican-Democrat as it does, you know, crony and who will deliver what the establishment wants. And clearly, Alan Greenspan was in there with Rockefeller. They were very, very tight. This is Greenspan talking about his 50th birthday party, which was at the time he was dating Barbara Walters. Here we go. "Even so, I did build up a wonderful circle of friends. Barbara threw me a 50th birthday party at her house. The guests were the people I'd come to think of as my New York friends." Okay, now get a load of this. Henry and Nancy Kissinger, Oscar and Annette De Laurenta, Felix and Liz Rowatin, Brooke Astor, Joe and Estee Lauder, Henry and Louis Grunwald, Punch and Carol Sulzberger, Punch, of course, the owner of the New York Times, and David Rockefeller. And then he concludes, "I'm still friends with many of these people today more than 30 years later."
Robert, I met most of those people myself, and that's just the definition of the New York establishment in that time.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. That is the hardcore, the center, a dozen people, and Greenspan's in the middle of it, and he becomes Fed chairman. Before that, Volcker clearly had a Rockefeller connection. So it crosses party lines.
Yes, and Greenspan really worked out, you know, the system that Bernanke has perfected, where the government finances itself by buying its own bonds, but it does so surreptitiously by having Wall Street buy them. So the government buys the Wall Street bonds, and that gives the money to Wall Street to buy the government bonds. So in effect, the government's buying its own bonds, but it's all, you know, hidden.
Right, right. And Bernanke's introduced even more tools, which makes it more complicated. But you recently put a comment up at Mises.org at the Circle Bastiat blog, and you discussed Keynes as far as an investor. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think you hit on a key point there.
Well, I was responding to an article written by some people from Cambridge University that used some archives to make the case that Keynes was a brilliant investor. And of course, that's part of his myth, because, you know, he's supposed to be not just an economist with his head in the clouds. He's supposed to be a very practical guy who made himself so rich through his investments, and all the more reason that we should trust him. And so I just pointed out that that's all poppycock, that, you know, he was a successful investor for himself in that he made himself a reasonably big fortune, but it was not a huge fortune, and he kept making mistakes. He went bust once in his poor dad, who was just a teacher, had to bail him out. He was using borrowed money. He continued to use borrowed money, you know, right along, and to concentrate and to speculate. At the same time, of course, he was excoriating speculation in the economy. The speculation was terrible, but he, of course, was doing it. He was taking big risks. And the article that I was rebutting, you know, also said that he was a precursor of people like Warren Buffett and Soros and so on, which he wasn't, particularly not Buffett, because Keynes was just an absolute out-and-out speculator, and Buffett is not.
Right. You know, another point you made in there is that he lost money during the Great Depression, which Bernard Baruch did also. I mean, there's a great myth that Baruch was short going into the Great Depression, but he was not. He covered his shorts before the crash occurred.
But Keynes almost went smash again in 1929. I mean, he came close, because again, right, he was using borrowed money, and then again in 1937, he almost went under as well.
But now what is interesting, the one period where he did make money was, and you pointed this out in the post, is when he had a substantial amount of his net worth in gold stock. I mean, this guy is anti-gold, calls gold a barbarous relic, and yet about the only time he ever made any really serious money was when he loaded up on gold stocks, which you point out in your post. And my contention is that that was a planned manipulation by Baruch and by Keynes. They were both desperate. They had both lost a lot of money. Whether they urged FDR to prop up the gold price after FDR confiscated gold that Americans held or before is not clear, but they certainly, Baruch and Keynes were certainly both very instrumental in egging FDR onto propping up the gold price.
Keynes only had one meeting with Roosevelt, and that was the only known communication between the two of them. So Roosevelt was always doing these Keynesian things. But I think we'd be wrong to think that Keynes was whispering in his ear.
Well, actually, I have published on my site a letter that Keynes wrote to FDR's people alerting him that he was going to be coming out with an article that was going to be calling for support for the gold price, and that was published in the New York Times.
Well, it was true. I mean, he was in close touch with Felix Frankfurter and other sort of close Roosevelt assistants, but he didn't have time with Roosevelt himself except for once. there might have been inside information involved also because, as you know, when Roosevelt took away everybody's gold, he did not take their gold mining stocks.
Right.
The gold mining stocks became the only place where you could be if you wanted gold.
Exactly.
Which helped gold mining stocks.
Right.
So if Keynes knew what was coming, obviously that was a help.
Yeah, there was clear correspondence back and forth between Keynes, who lived in England, and the FDR camp, also with Baruch. And if you go further into the history of that period, there's a newsletter publisher, bank analyst by the name of Marty Weiss, and his father, Irving Weiss, was friends with Baruch, and Irving Weiss loaded up on gold and silver stocks at that time. Irving Weiss never came out and said, hey, we had inside information, but he did make clear that Baruch expected the gold price to shoot up before the FDR started propping up the price. So you had that Keynes-Baruch circle where especially Keynes out of nowhere starts buying gold stocks. When FDR makes it illegal, you would think that that will cause less of a supply for gold. And Keynes is buying all these stocks, and then suddenly out of nowhere, FDR starts to prop up the price of gold when every other price is collapsing at that time.
Also, just to make Keynes' self-contradiction more puzzling, in addition to owning those gold mining shares, throughout the 30s and 40s, he counseled other institutions like colleges and universities and with their endowment funds, oh, you should own some gold, it's an excellent diversifier. At the same time, as you point out, he was calling it a barbarous relic.
Right, right, exactly. So you have Keynes making public statements in one sense, but personally and for the groups he advises doing something very, very different. And then, of course, he did call for FDR to prop up the price in the letter that appeared in the New York Times, which he alerted to the FDR administration before he put it out. But anyways, let's get back to your crony capitalism book. Where do you see things going now? How do you see them developing? And do we have a chance to get out of this vicious circle? Or
I would say that there are two big problems with the economy. And one is bad economic policies, and the other, this corruption of crony capitalism. And they're closely linked. Because the bad economic policies, the Keynesian policies, just naturally create all this corruption of crony capitalism. They expand the role of government throughout the economy. That brings in more and more private interests who want to buy government as a result. The economic policies also finance government's expansion into the economy through low interest rates and through allowing the government to buy bonds from itself and all that kind of thing. So we have this very vicious circle. It's hard to know how it can be broken because there are really no signs at the moment of any way out. Of course, all these things together, as is often pointed out, you know, kick the can down the road. They make the economy look better for a little while, you know, just like giving more dope to an addict, it makes him feel better for a little while. But in the long run, they just make it worse. There's really nothing on the horizon that would suggest there's a way out of this.
Mm-hmm. If there were to be a way out, what would it take? Would it have to take a change in the attitude of the general public? Would they have to understand it or at least reject the crony capitalism somehow? I mean, I tend to agree with you. I mean, it seems like it's near impossible for this to break unless the masses sort of reject it, but it doesn't seem they understand it completely. And you have the government propaganda machine moving to cause government to go into more different sectors like healthcare and
The only way you can get, you know, government to make a change, of course, is to get the public involved. And the public right now is so confused. You know, it just doesn't know. It knows the economy is terrible. It knows that there's real trouble here, but it doesn't know why, what to do about it. So we've got to get the public, you know, on the right side. And when I talk to my friends on the left, they say the economy is bad. We need more regulation. You know, I can argue that, well, the expansion of the government, the increase in regulation, has only created more crony capitalism, so how can more regulation be the answer? But I think more especially, I'd say to them, don't worry about more or less regulation. Start to think about what kind of regulation you want. You know, what kind of regulation is effective? And then I make the argument that if the government will just stop interfering with prices, if they'll stop the price interference, the price manipulations, the price controls, that's the key to it. You can really arrest crony capitalism if you get government out of price setting. And after all, what is it that the special interests want to buy from government? They want to buy interventions on prices. In Obamacare, it's throughout every single industry you can name. Private interests are trying to get the government to intervene on prices. That's what they're buying.
Right. An important section in your book is a section you call losers. And in that, you talk about charity, poor, and the war on the young. Can you talk about that? Because I think you really hit the nail on the head there.
Well, I must say it angers me that current economic policies work so directly against the young and the poor and the middle class. I mean, you know, if government should be trying to help anybody, it's got to be the poor, the middle class, and the young. And the young, of course, are the poorest, by the way. I mean, by now, the older people are far, far richer than younger people. It's younger people who are the poorest. And yet, these poor young people, poor economically and otherwise, are being sent out in the world, you know, saddled with all this educational debt, which, again, is just a misfired government policy. The government provides these student loan subsidies. What happened is that it drove up the cost of education, the fees and tuition so on rose because of all this available money. So the student has the loan available but now has to pay much bigger bills. So the student takes it in the air. The student, of course, and the young person took it in the air with Obamacare. One of the themes of Obamacare, of course, is that we're going to simply charge young much, much more so that we can then charge less to older people who have problems. You know, once again, it's the young. It's so strange that Obama carried the under 30 vote to such an extent, you know, this last election. It's just because young people don't understand what's going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it comes right back to the whole education thing. You have government funding the education. You have a terribly poor quality of education that these students get. I mean, they can't get jobs, never mind understand how the economy works. And that's all because of the government influence and what they're actually learning. So it's a terrible situation. And the fact that Obama does receive so much support from the young after what he's doing to them, I mean, it's a perfect example of just how corrupt the education system is, that these kids don't get economics 101.
And of course, there's a good deal of lying going on. I mean, for example, the president during the campaign and afterwards, he's taken credit for, quote, getting interest rates down on student loans, reducing the cost of them, which is nonsense, because what's actually happens is that the federal government borrows at no interest, virtually no interest, and then it reloans to students at much higher interest. So naturally, the federal government's making a profit on that, and they're booking it in the budget under deficit reduction. So they're just not acknowledging that.
Yeah. You know, one of my other favorite topics is charity, and you touch on this. You have the chapter titled, Charity Gets No Respect.
Well, of course, Obama, throughout his administration, has tried to take away the charitable deduction for wealthy people, which is
right.
One of the absolute most important contributors of revenue to nonprofits and charities. And I think he does that not just because he wants the money. He also doesn't like the competition of charities with the government. He wants people entirely dependent on the government. He doesn't want, you know, charities there showing that it can be done in a better way, particularly working with the poor and helping the poor. If I were running things, I would, instead of eliminating the charitable deduction, I would increase it. I would say to wealthy people, we'll have a flat tax to finance the government, but we'll have an extra bracket for the wealthy. But if you don't want to pay that extra tax, you can just give it to charity for social service charities that will help the poor and that kind of thing.
Yeah. One of the things that drives me crazy is when the president always says, when somebody challenges him about one of his giveaway programs, he says, well, isn't that the neighborly thing to do? And I think what he's doing there is creating a myth that charity can only come through the government, which I think it's a terrible insult to the American people, because I don't think the American people want to see homeless, starving people on the streets. And if there was no government, people would certainly give to charities to help those people out. So I think it's a great myth that he creates that government has to be there to be the neighbor or to enforce the charitable acts.
And of course, he wants the government providing all the benefits because that's the way of buying votes.
Yeah. So is he just a crony operator? Is he a socialist, a combination? What is your take?
Most especially, you know, he is a Chicago-style operator. He came in offering, you know, moderation and change and all those kind of things, but what he really brought was the epitome of crony capitalism, which you have in Chicago. George W. Bush was certainly up to his neck in crony capitalism, but I don't think he really understood it. I mean, when he said he had to suspend the free enterprise system in order to save it, you know, he really believed that. He didn't understand what he was doing, but I think Obama's been very clear in what he's been doing all along, which is expand the reach of government, you know, get more and more groups beholden to government, finance it through cheap money from the Fed and deficit spending. And it's a program, you know, designed to create a permanent Democratic Party majority.
Yeah, I think he's very good at understanding, as you point out, on how to pull the levers behind the scenes. And he really understands the intricacies of pushing and pulling and what it's going to do for the vote and all that sort of thing.
He does things like, you know, he creates a jobs council, which is supposed to advise him on how to make the economy better. But in fact, he puts in the jobs council his major campaign contributors. And so he's rewarding his campaign contributors by bringing them to the White House and his jobs council.
Yeah. What's your take on Hillary Clinton if she follows up the Obama administration?
Well, it would seem to be more of the same.
Right. All right. Why don't you quickly, Hunter, just tell us about your other book, Free Prices Now, Fixing the Economy by Abolishing the Fed.
I touched on it in that if there was one reform that could really change things in this economy and help the middle class and the poor, it would be to get the government out of prices. The whole essence of Keynesianism is this interference with the price system, and the economy simply cannot survive, much less thrive, if prices are continually manipulated and controlled and interfered with. The book is about the importance of prices, how they are the, you know, what we all rely on in the economy to tell us what we need to know in order to make decisions, and how the price system is just being destroyed right now. Something needs to be done about it, and the first thing people have to understand is this issue, how it relates to crony capitalism, the expansion of government, the increase in corruption, and how it relates to their future in terms of jobs and economics.
Okay, we've been talking to Hunter Lewis. Hunter, thanks very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. You've done some exciting work, anti-Keynesian work, pro-Austrian economic work, and your number one book, you've got two coming out, but the big book is Crony Capitalism in America, 2008-2012, which does a step-by-step takedown of crony capitalism and discusses how it's involved in everything from Hurricane Sandy to Fannie and Freddie, the interest rate manipulation, minimum wages, so on and so forth, and how cronies get involved in all this. And it's a well worth read. Hunter, thanks very much for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Robert Wenzel Show. This is Robert Wenzel. Be sure to check out my website, economicpolicyjournal.com, where I blog 7 days a week about economics, finance, politics, and liberty. Executive producer of the Robert Wenzel Show is Chris Rossini. Head of editing and mastering is John Daubert.